From NPR, it's Latino USA. In 2009, President Obama called for a new Green Deal, evoking FDR's New Deal of the 1930s. The goal of the Obama plan was to create millions of green jobs. But has that happened?
There's no question the green economy is growing. It's growing more quickly than any other industry right now in this country. The question is, how do communities of color access that economy?
Imperial County sits at the southeastern corner of California, bordering both Mexico and Arizona. It's 80% Latino and has one of the country's highest unemployment rates. But some believe the renewable energy resources they're sitting on will change all that.
What geothermal has done for this district is they have given me enough cash and property taxes so I don't have a cash flow problem and I can make payroll.
I'm Maria Hinojosa, and that's coming up on Latino USA. But first this. Murders in Puerto Rico have reached an all-time high with more than 1,000 people killed just this year. Puerto Rican police say it's the highest murder rate since 1994, and the year isn't even over yet. Authorities say poverty, high unemployment rates, and the island's thriving drug trade are to blame. Joining us now is Alfredo Montalvo Barbot. He's an associate professor of sociology and criminology at Emporia State University in Emporia, Kansas. Welcome to Latino USA, Professor.
Thank you.
In 1994, the murder rate was almost as high as it is today's, and the mid-1990s were high crime in many, many places. So give us some kind of historical context on why were the crime levels that high in 1994 and why they are the same rate this many years later.
Well, in 1994, the murder rate and crime rate in general was high for the same reason that they were high in the United States, meaning the gang activities, the crack epidemic, the availability of weapons, and drug trafficking. So now, in 2011, we are seeing the same issues, except maybe gangs, but then we still have a significant problem of drug trafficking. Weapons are all over the place. And we have to keep in mind that many of those people that we put in prison in the 1980s and 1990s, with what I call the incarceration binge, are now back into society. They have been released. So these people are coming back to reoffend or to be victimized or to finish their business. And unemployment, of course, is one of the main problems.
Puerto Rico has received about $260 million in direct federal support for crime prevention since 2008, including forensic science and essentially trying to strengthen the judicial system. So $260 million, is it helping?
Well, it seems like it's not. I mean, the statistics on crime will show you that we have been throwing money at this problem for a long time, and we haven't seen results. And part of the problem, of course, you have to deal with the issue of corruption within the government, corruption with the police, and transparency. I mean, what are we doing with this money?
Is the government clear? Are the books open in terms of the $260 million that are, you know, taxpayer dollars in Puerto Rico?
Well, it doesn't seem like it. We know, for instance, when they buy new equipment for the police, when they hire new more police officers. But in recent years, we have seen the consequences of mass recruitment of officers. We have a lot of corruption within the government, within the police. So we need to attack the problems from that perspective also.
So drug trafficking. I mean, people have been talking about drug trafficking in Puerto Rico for years upon years upon years. So there still isn't a handle on the problem, and in fact, it's getting worse?
Absolutely. The federal government has been successful in attacking the problem in other places. It seemed to be increasing in Puerto Rico. Until we solve this problem, we won't be able to solve all the problems.
One of the other issues that you bring up is the question of impunity. 42% of the people suspected in these murders, only 42%, less than half, have been caught.
Absolutely. Many of these people will move to other places. They will move to the United States. They will go to Dominican Republic. They will escape justice. So it's very difficult to send a message to people that you will get caught and you will pay the consequences.
All right. And finally, reports say that close to 90% of the deaths in Puerto Rico, the murders in Puerto Rico, were committed with firearms. Were you surprised by that number? And is Puerto Rico now becoming an island filled with firearms?
Well, I'm not surprised by the statistics. What I'm surprised about is the fact that the government hasn't put a lot of effort into tracking down the trafficking of weapons. That has to be addressed, too. We only know about the weapons when we have arrests made and they find weapons. But the government needs to concentrate their effort into finding those weapons and getting those weapons out of circulation. And more importantly, how do they get there? It's a very important issue that the government will have to address.
Well, thanks for all of your work on this issue, Alfredo.
My pleasure.
Alfredo Montalvo Barbot is an associate professor of sociology and criminology at Emporia State University in Kansas. He wrote Crime in Puerto Rico, Drug Trafficking, Money Laundering, and the Poor for the journal Crime and Delinquency. For news updates throughout the week, check out our website at latinousa.org. You can follow us on Twitter or become our friend on Facebook. We are Latino USA, all one word, and we're back in 30 segundos. That's 30 seconds. Stay with us. It's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. During Barack Obama's 2008 presidential campaign, he promised to create 5 million green jobs to boost the clean energy sector, lower skyrocketing unemployment, and end America's dependence on foreign oil. But it hasn't happened. And now with the cloud of federally funded solar panel maker Solyndra's recent $500 million collapse, there's a lot of talk about whether those initially planted green job seeds will ever bear much fruit. Joining us to talk about this is Phaedra Ellis-Lamkins. She's the chief executive officer of Green for All, one of the country's leading advocates for a clean energy economy. Phaedra, thank you for speaking with us on Latino USA.
Thank you so much for having me.
So if you had to come up with a headline, President promises green jobs, says a lot of the jobs are going to go into economically challenged communities. Have those jobs been delivered? Has the transformation to a green economy actually happened in terms of jobs?
Well, here's what's not debatable. The green economy is growing, right? 8.3% annually, year over year, which is pretty important. The question of where it's growing is really one of what we do to make sure it does. We have an example in the city of Portland where we've worked and over 500 people have received paychecks, half of who are women and people of color. So I think it is certainly where it's happening in targeted areas. We see really, really good examples. But is it as wide as I'd like it to be? No. Is it as significant? But I think it's hard to call the question on the president when most cities and states only got the money 6 months ago. So it's hard to expect an incredible amount of new jobs in less than 6 months.
So in terms of the kinds of jobs, when you're talking about low income, low skilled, people of color, are these the kinds of jobs that could be available in a green economy?
You know, here's what is exciting to me about the green economy is that it actually does offer entry-level jobs with on-the-job training. And so, you know, when people want to know what are green jobs, first, there are things like people have to improve their water systems, so it can be construction jobs. There's installation of projects. You know, I sat this week with someone who's doing a system that makes skylights more effective. He's building a plant in Texas, which will employ a lot of folks in manufacturing. The real question is, how do we make sure that the green economy is a manufacturing economy, which means that people we know will go to work? The opportunity of the green economy is that, you know, we have to be the kind of country, we want to be the kind of country that, you know, imports water and batteries and toys and food. And so we have to start to make things in this country again. And the people most likely to get those jobs are in communities of color.
But I wonder whether or not, because the green jobs have trickled in, whether or not there's a kind of impatience of, you know, there was supposed to be this green economy, hasn't been delivered, still out of work. You know, we're kind of like we're ready to move on. Do you get that sense in a lot of economically disadvantaged communities when they don't see the green jobs immediately turning up?
Well, first, there's no question the green economy is growing. It's growing more quickly than any other industry right now in this country. The question is, how do communities of color access that economy? We're in the midst of a recession. And green jobs are just not naturally good because they're green. We still have to have economic development strategies that we figure out how to get those jobs in the communities that need them the most. What we know is in places where they have really clear strategies, Portland, Sacramento, stuff that's now going to be happening in Texas, the Tesla factory that's now in Fremont, California, that we see when there's a very clear strategy to get those jobs, we get those jobs. The thing I think we all fear is I remember when communities of color were paying a lot of attention to things like Cisco networking academies. And we'd see all of our communities training people for jobs that went away 1 year later. But we have to learn the lessons from that, which is understand where the economy is growing and target training to where there's real jobs. So if I was thinking about what type of training programs, I'd be thinking not just about construction. I'd think about water. I'd think about food. And that's why this information about where their job growth is the most critical piece of information for our communities.
All right, Phaedra, thanks so much for joining us on Latino USA.
Thank you so much for having me.
Phaedra Ellis-Lamkins is the Chief Executive Officer of Green for All. Find out more on our website at latinousa.org. And now, we're going to turn our attention to a new green energy resource. And it all starts in California's Imperial County, which sits in the hot, dry, southeastern portion of the state. With a population that's 80% Latino, traditional agriculture jobs have long been the mainstay of the economy. But times are tight, and the unemployment rate now stands at a staggering 30%. People are scrambling for jobs, looking anywhere for new sources of income. That's why many cheered Governor Jerry Brown's recent signing of a law that requires California to get 30% of its electricity from renewable energy sources within the next decade. The small town of Calipatria sits atop abundant geothermal activity, and the people there are hoping that the new law will give this town just the green economic boost it needs. From California, Lisa Morehouse has our story.
It's important to know that it's hot around here. It's hot above ground, where temperatures reach 120 degrees, and it's hot underground, too. The earthquake faults here mean there's plenty of geothermal activity, which is why so many community leaders say the same thing.
So the renewables revolution is going to be taking place here. This is going to be ground zero.
Calipatria will be the center of the renewable energy effort that's going on.
We have the potential to provide energy for the whole state of California.
Just north of Calipatria, the wheat, onion, and alfalfa fields are occasionally interrupted by power plants emitting steam. The company Cal Energy operates 10 plants in this area. They drill into the earth, pulling up hot brine, flashing it to separate out steam, which runs through a turbine to make electricity. These plants alone produce over 300 megawatts of electricity, most of which goes to Los Angeles. That's enough to power nearly 200,000 homes. Countywide, it's estimated that geothermal operations are only tapping a quarter of the resource. Right now, companies are investing hundreds of millions of dollars in exploration, planning, and plant construction. But how much does this help the town of Calipatria? Even though the town is near a cluster of geothermal plants, only 6% of Cal Energy plant employees live in Calipatria. Most commute from around the region, some from as far away as Palm Springs, 90 miles away.
We're the Persian Gulf of California as far as the energy.
Luis Sendejas owns Calipatria's hardware store with his sons. He thinks renewables should benefit more than big corporations and a few small businesses like his own.
Those rich countries in the Persian Gulf, they got so much money, but just a few people enjoying it, and everybody else is so poor, you know, uneducated. And it resembles a little bit to the Imperial Valley, because we have all the natural resources. We're going to be growing all the energy, but a few people will be taking advantage of it, you know.
One clear benefit of geothermal comes in property taxes. Cal Energy is already the county's single largest taxpayer, which benefits Calipatria's public schools. Doug Klein is school superintendent. He weighs in during morning school bus duty.
What geothermal has done for this district is they have given me enough cash and property taxes so I don't have a cash flow problem and I can make payroll. The property tax is so high, we collect about $3.5 million in property tax. We gain 81% of that basically comes from geothermal.
But Klein says too few people in the area are being prepared to work in renewable energy, especially given Calipatria's unemployment rate of 26%.
What the hell are we thinking? We have all these people walking around without jobs. We have an industry that's going to blow up. What they need is skilled labor out there.
Klein regrets that the high school's welding program, which got a number of graduates employed at local plants, shrank when the teacher retired. And he couldn't get a bond passed for the technical training facility he envisions. High school student Cindy Zendejas, Luis's granddaughter, says there aren't many ways for her fellow students to connect to the growing industry around them.
Okay, we don't really learn about, like, the solar stuff and all that geothermal, because when we do, like, we don't get into the topic really strongly, like, in other topics. So, like, I don't think they know, like, what it might be or, like, what the future is with it.
Local unions and colleges are adding training as they can. Luis Zendejas thinks the future of Calipatria and its largely Latino youth depends on young people being educated for more than skilled labor jobs.
If you give them math and science and they become engineers or doctors or professionals or something like that, some of them will come back and be the pillars of the community in the future, you know.
But it's a chicken or egg dilemma. Do you prepare people for jobs that may exist in the future or for jobs that exist now? On a Friday night out in the desert, 31 students from Imperial Valley College are in a nighttime shooting class, getting feedback from instructors as they prepare for careers in law enforcement.
Hey, you got 19 in, and then the rest are right in here. So you're doing real well, real well.
The Administration of Justice is the most popular major at this community college. Imperial's two big prisons, Border Patrol, and immigration detention facilities employ thousands of people. For now, geothermal only employs a few hundred permanently.
Left, ready, alert!
Some local farmers are starting to lease land to solar energy companies, which are gaining footholds in the area. But what about jobs? After construction, solar farms need very few employees. Many locals agree this town needs manufacturing jobs, like solar panel construction, but there's no guarantee those types of businesses will locate here. County Supervisor Gary Wyatt.
And in this country, you don't tell people where to locate their businesses. They locate them where they feel is best for their business and where they will have the most success.
He says it's up to small towns like Calipatria to market themselves.
It's a competitive world. You've got to let people know who you are and what you've got to offer.
For his part, Luis Zendejas hopes Calipatria leaders can lure manufacturing work here. He also wants the town to have long-term vision. He's a self-made businessman, and he believes Calipatria's young people should have opportunities here.
Somebody has to break the cycle and then get into a different mode of progress, you know. When I first came here, I thought I was going to be a farm worker, like my father. So I kind of broke the cycle, and I realized that there is a dream out here that you can really bank on it.
And Calipatria is poised to see if its renewable resources will benefit the town as a whole as the demand for renewable energy grows. For Latino USA, I'm Lisa Morehouse in Calipatria, California.
We're going to take a short break now. We'll be back in 1 minute. That's un minuto. So no se vayan. Stay with us. Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. As part of our Radio Nature series, stories of how Latinos connect to nature in powerful ways, today we have a unique conversation with renowned children's book author Jan Bosarth, where themes of nature, magic, and girl empowerment are all linked together in her children's books. First, a little bit more background about the author, Jan Bosarth. She was raised in Texas in the 1960s. She's the daughter of a Cuban mother and a Welsh father. She studied flower essences when she was 18 years old and went on to study music, art, and poetry in college. As a young girl, she dreamed of a life that would somehow weave all of these different interests together. That dream came true when the Fairy Godmother Academy book series was born. Jan, we're so pleased to have you on Latino USA.
Hi, Maria.
So just paint a picture for somebody who's never read one of the Fairy Godmother Academy books. Take us into the world of the Fairy Godmother.
The girls in the books are modern-day girls, and they're unknowing heiresses to the secret lineages of fairy godmothers. And all of the information that they have is what is handed down through their mothers and their grandmothers and their aunts, so the women and their family. And the only way to really train to be a fairy godmother in their lineage is to enter the world of aventurine. It's a fantasy world that can only be entered through their dreams. Aventurine is a parallel world, having mountains and rivers and plants and valleys. And there's beauty and there's also danger, just like there is in the real world.
All right, well, before we dive deep into aventurine, I want to talk a little bit about your real life experience as a half Cuban, half Welsh in Texas. And this communication that you started developing with nature when you were a young girl. So talk a little bit about that.
My father traveled the world, and he would bring me stones from foreign countries. So definitely the way I experienced the world was unique. And I would sit out in the yard and feel the wind and look at the trees and stare into nature, and that was the way I created. The dreams of going back to Cuba were visceral in our lives. And Cuba being an island, we were always connected to the water. I think that was probably my first love before plants and stones. So that is definitely Cuba. And the music. By the way, I write all the music for these projects. And so music was my first art form. So I'm always connecting through music that way, or through my Cuban mother's soul that way.
So nature plays a central and powerful role in this enchanted land of yours, of adventuring. Why this theme throughout your book?
What I wanted to do was explore the natural world through the storytelling. And I wanted the plants and the animals in the land of adventuring to mimic the real world to a degree, but have something more magical about it. Children in general, and all people really, do experience nature that way. They may not be aware of it. I help articulate the experience for them.
You have something that you want to read to us from the first book that really shows your relationship as a writer to nature.
Yes, I'm reading from the very first book of the series, Birdie's book. And Birdie is the main character here. She's just arrived in New York City. She's been unplanted from her beautiful green Califa, which is what she calls California, where she was a big-time gardener. And she's living in a high-rise in New York City, and she's on her way up to see her grandmother. I had a new name for her immediately, Lilium tigrinium, the Latin name for tiger lily, a constant tropical bloomer. That's practically the opposite of Mom, who is more like a calla lily, straight and stiff and stoically beautiful. Naming people after flowers and plants is one of my games. It's a great way to pass boring hours at school. Of course, I never use the same name twice, not even for twins. I know a lot of flower names.
That's so cute.
So she names all of the people after the Latin botanical names for flowers or plants.
So what's your message about the importance of connecting to nature?
My message is to stop, look, and listen, to appreciate the things around us, the beauty that surrounds us, and to let it inspire you, let it ignite your senses, and see where you go from there.
Thanks so much for speaking with us on Latino USA, Jan.
Thanks, Maria.
Jan Bosarth is the children's book author of the Fairy Godmother Academy book series. She spoke to us from KUT in Austin. For more information about her work, go to our website at latinousa.org. And finally this week, some personal thoughts on Arizona and the Supreme Court. Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor may be the wisest Latina of them all, but I can only imagine how she feels right now. The thing that wise Latinas often dread is that we're held up to represent an entire people when sometimes all we want is to be seen as simply equal. But now that the Supreme Court has decided to rule on the Arizona immigration law, all eyes eventually will be on the first Latina to sit on the Supreme Court. Powerful and wise Latinas in the U.S. face a constant challenge to prove their identity as full-fledged Americans, to declare their allegiances, to show their hearts. Behind it all is a question often laced with a suspicion. Who are you really? Are you one of us? Many of you might actually think that she'll err on the side of immigrants because Sotomayor is an immigrant. Thanks to the demonization in the media, every Latino is considered to be an outsider or an undocumented immigrant. But Sotomayor is not an immigrant. First of all, Puerto Ricans are American citizens by birth, and they're not immigrants to the mainland. Secondly, she was raised in that quintessential American spot, the Bronx. Because of her own experience of growing up among the working poor in a Spanish-speaking barrio, she's seen the treatment of immigrants from a very close human and legal perspective. And because she has the strongest of academic credentials coming from Princeton, she also understands the legally complicated issue of immigrants living in this country without valid visas or paperwork. In her first term on the Supreme Court, Sotomayor was the first justice officially to use the term undocumented immigrant in the court's ledgers. Yet many will believe that Sotomayor's allegiance to this country will be shown in her decision on Arizona. But could it be that a woman who has been infused with all of the perspectives and knowledge from a full, complicated, and multi-layered experience of being a Latina in the U.S. might have the chance of offering an opinion that might be wiser than the men who have ruled our country and our world? The reality is that wise Latinas just want to be seen as equal and as part of this country. They want to be seen as having strong opinions and that their perspectives and decisions can only benefit the greater good. And they want to stop being questioned about their real motives and alliances. The question is, after the Arizona decision, what will people see in Justice Sonia Sotomayor? And that's it for this week on Latino USA. Funding for our series, Radio Nature, is provided by the REI Foundation, supporting today's youth to develop a lifetime commitment to nature and the outdoors. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next week for another edition of NPR's Latino USA.
Funding for Latino USA is provided in part by the Marguerite Casey Foundation, supporting families leading change.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the American Jewish World Service, pursuing global justice through grassroots change at ajws.org, and Lumber Liquidators, offering hardwood flooring. Catalogs and professional installation details are available. 1-800-HARDWOOD. And the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for improving education and enrichment for children, both in and out of school, at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.